ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with co-hosts Justin Darcy and Taylor Dyke.
Welcome to episode 24 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Jimmy Unwellers, Avesta Bloodstock. Joining me today is co-host Taylor Dyke and our special guest, David Redvers. David is the racing manager at one of the world's largest racing organisations, Qatar Racing, while also managing Tween Hills Farm, the home of Stallions Cameco and Lightning Spear, both raced by Qatar. The team also retains shares in Wynn-based Stallions Zusane, Jackano, Zoostar, and the newly announced Southport Tycoon, adding to their global reputation of being one of the industry's heavyweight giants. David, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Good morning.
Clearly an incredibly successful person within the industry with an obvious passion for the thoroughbred. Where did your racing and bloodstock interest initially develop from?
Well, slightly unusually and surprisingly, I suppose, it came from Australia, 90% of it. And basically, I grew up in Gloucestershire, which is very much horse country in the UK, very close to Cheltenham Racecourse, which is sort of the home of national hunt racing. And I remember an early memory of Dawn Run winning the Gold Cup in 1986, a long time before you guys were even dreamt of. And that was when I was 16 as a schoolboy, but I didn't really have a huge interest, if I'm honest. My mother, I grew up sort of riding and hunting, and so I always loved the horse, but I racing itself per se wasn't particularly of interest. Then in my gap year, I went out to Australia and I ended up working for a guy called John Gould down in Victoria, and then he was a polo player, Aussie rules footballer actually, first and foremost, a polo player, and he had his own hunt in near Camperdown, so I worked for him for a little bit, and then I worked for a guy called Chaz Armitage, whose father had been chairman of the BRC, Peter Armitage. He was down in, down in the Grampians. And I sort of helped them break in horses, and I started thinking about racing, because that was obviously part of the culture down there. But I then, you know, probably the bit that transformed my ideas about what I was going to do in life was I worked for Vincent Deirdre Steen at Rocklea Stud at Bathurst, which was, I think it'd be fair to say, quite a sort of rough, tough outfit. She trained Rising Prince to win the Cox Plate. I mean, she was the first, she was long before Gay, you know, she was the first female trainer to really make a mark. And was as tough as old boots, and, you know, kicked me around a bit, which is what I needed at that stage. But it also woke up my eyes to the fact that you could have a business around horses, didn't necessarily need a huge amount of acreage, which was, you know, my family farm was relatively small from an acreage perspective, so wouldn't have been commercially viable as a farm. But I came home full of, you know, having been at the Easter sales with yearlings, full of dreams of how I could turn Tween Hills into a stud farm. And so, yeah, that's where my love of racing came from, was that working in back of the Blue Mountains at Bathurst, I suppose.
With Cheltenham just around the corner, our editor Lydia Simmons told us that you actually started your career buying jumpers, including the brilliant hurdler Lady Rebecca. Is jumps racing something you're still passionate about?
Yeah, massively. I mean, when I came home, obviously I wanted to get going straight away, so I ended up working on a couple of studs in the UK, but as soon as I could, I was always looking at buying a few horses, trading, getting involved. And one of the very first horses I bought was a £400, I mean, we're talking $800 is what she cost me, National Hunt yearling, who ended up being Lady Rebecca. She won 3 grade one hurdles at Cheltenham. She actually, at the time, had the record for the most numbers of wins at Cheltenham, or joint most numbers of wins for the Horse Horse Silver Fame. And it was she was the Cinderella story, if you like, for British racing, National Hunt racing at the time, and gave us a real start. So I've still got two of her daughters, three of her granddaughters here. It's a bit of a taxation on emotional weakness having a national breeding operation. So we turned flat quite quickly. But yes, I mean, my local track is Cheltenham. There is, it's almost incomparable, Cheltenham Festival and the atmosphere on a racetrack to anywhere else. Possibly the Melbourne Cup comes close. I think some of the Japanese big races, because of the fan base, come close, but you don't get more passion on a race course than you do at Cheltenham.
In terms of our Aussie listeners who may not have been over to Cheltenham before, you mentioned there that obviously it's a passionate group of people and a large number of people that do attend Cheltenham. Just in comparison to, say, a Melbourne Cup, how big is Cheltenham in terms of the racing calendar in the UK?
I think it's fair to say that in the overall calendar, it's one of the sort of big three meetings. With regards to National Hunt Racing, it's the meeting. You've got Aintree here as well, but for the Grand National. But the truth is, Cheltenham is a week-long meeting. It's a four-day meeting in March. I think Ireland is deserted for that week. Everyone seems to come here from Ireland. There's a good French interest as well. So it's a rare thing from a national hunt race meeting that it's a pretty international affair. There'll be quite a few Americans come over, quite a few French. A few Aussies making the trip to come and have a look from time to time. But it's huge. I mean, I'm not quite sure what we'd do in our winter if it wasn't for Cheltenham, because everything leads towards the festival in March and next week. And you feel, you know, it's now light outside in the mornings and spring is, you know, we've got foals popping out left, right and centre and calving like crazy as well. So we're into spring, we're into Cheltenham. The next thing after that is the flat racing season.
Incredible. It certainly is a bucket list festival for mine. But we'll talk a little bit now about your work with Qatar. The business is chaired by Sheikh Fahad and the Maroon Silks are recognised globally. Qatar Racing has now been in existence for around 13 years and look to have had success right from the get-go. Could you talk us through this racing journey and how the business ties with KIPCO?
Yeah, sure. So Qatar Racing is basically a child of KIPCO, if you like. KIPCO is the parent company. It's a holding company for Sheikh Fahad and his brothers. Sheikh Hamad is his older brother, who's the boss, if you like. And he absolutely, you know, loves racing, loves the scene in Britain. And they've been involved now with me for about 15 years, involved in British horse racing since then. I was actually in New Zealand at the yearling sales at Karaka when I got a message that there was a young sheikh who'd like to meet me in London. And so at the time I was a bit nervous that might be a fake sheikh, because there were quite a few fake sheikh things going on in the sun. But I got it checked out and jumped on a plane and came back and met Sheikh Fahad, who at the time was I don't think he'd even turned 21. And we started on this journey, which within 2 years had won us the Melbourne Cup with Dunedin. And that started his love affair with Australian racing. And it's been a roller coaster. We've had some incredible highs with Dunedin, Roaring Lion, who was a world champion, Kamiko, who's a really exciting young stallion here now, who won a 2,000 guineas for us. And we've got lots of good stuff going on in Australia. We had a Group 1 winner in Australia again last year in Buckaroo. And we've got some very exciting horses to run there again this year. So it's a global operation. He's basically now largely based out of the Bahamas. I'm afraid our taxation system ain't great here at the moment. We've got a very left-wing government who are driving a lot of these non-doms away. But he loves American racing. He's very involved in American racing as well. But it's a global operation. You know, we had a foal in Japan 2 days ago. But we're all over the shop.
We'll touch on some of those great horses that Qatar has raced and still do race very shortly. But one thing I do want to ask first is about your retained rider, O'Shane Murphy. We've seen glimpses of him here in Australia, clearly one of the best in the world and dominates at most race meetings that he does ride at. Tell us a little bit about him and I guess why Qatar works with him so closely.
Well, I spotted him, or we spotted him. In fact, to be fair, you'd have to be blind not to spot him when he was an apprentice at Andrew Balding's, and that he just had a different style. He's very physically strong, and he is extremely driven. He's one of the most intelligent guys in the weighing room, and is massively driven to the point that sometimes we worry about how driven he is. This year, that he says that the championship isn't his focus. He quite clearly could be champion jockey for a decade if he chose to. But I think he's wanting to do more travelling. I mean, he's out in Saudi Arabia again. He's all over the shop. He won the Indian 2000 Guineas the other day. He's obviously won a good race in Saudi. He's in Dubai. He's all over. He's literally globe trotting the whole time, and loving life doing so. But he, when we met him, he was an apprentice. I think he was 17, and we were very quick to jump on him and retain him. And we guided him. Well, I don't know if we guided him. That sounds a bit patronizing, really. But we certainly helped him get established, probably keep his feet on the ground a bit, and to the point today where he's, I would say, it'd be very fair to say, be in the top three jockeys in the world.
We'll run through now some of the notable horses that Qatar's race, and we'll kick off with no doubt one of the favourites ever to be raced by the team, and that's Roaring Lion, a stunning grey. He was a four-time Group 1 winner and, of course, an eventual stallion standing at Tween Hills prior to his passing in 2019.
Well, I'll move around the office because you can see it's rather tragic. A museum to Roaring Lion. We've got Roaring Lion bronzes, we've got Roaring Lion pictures, we've got Roaring Lion everything. He was definitely a favourite. He's a horse that we bought as a yearling early doors. Bought him as a yearling in Keeneland for, I think, 160,000. He was a beautiful son of Kissin's Joy. We'd sort of specifically targeted Kissin's Joy because we'd underbid Hawkbill, who was an Eclipse winner for Godolphin, and I kept an eye on the stallion ever since and had seen that he was champion turf sire in America, but they were very hard to buy. A lot of them had come out of poor mares that had been claimed by the Ramses, but they just had this incredible will to win, which was very noticeable. So I'd said to my team, Hannah Wall and Peter Mullaney at the sales, if you see a Kissin's Joy that's got action, I'm prepared to sort of forgive a bit else if it looks athletic. Anyway, that sale at Book One at Keeneland, Hannah said she spotted one with the most amazing action, a grey horse who looked slightly out of place in Book One at Keeneland because there were lots of tappets and big dirt brutes of horses. And there was this incredibly elegant, athletic son of Kissin's Joy. So we bought him for 160, Sheikh Fahd there. And he ended up being the best miler in, I think it was the top rated 3-year-old in the world that year, and the best miler in Europe. So he was pretty exceptional horse.
Yeah, absolutely, no doubt, a very special horse to yourself and all the team involved. This mare, although she didn't race in the Qatar Silks, you were involved in Champion Sprinter Sunlight, and she's arguably one of the most valuable brood mares we have in Australia at the moment. How did you guys actually get involved in her?
Well, when we bought into Zoostar, it was after he won the Coolmore. We probably should have bought into him before because he was on our radar. Anthony, was very keen that we didn't just buy shares in the stallion. We also invested in mares to support, and that we would go out of our way to find the right mares that would suit the stallion. So we bought into Solar Charge, who is we went halves, and Solar Charge, who was a lovely mare. She was actually, I think she's a wild card entry now that I remember.
at the chairman's sale, or I think that I might stand corrected. It was one of those sales, but I remember Anthony going, "Oh, before you go, there's a mare coming in late. She's a wild card, and she's got exactly the right profile." So I have to give him all credit to that. We bought her, and she was, as you say, probably one of the best investments we made, because she then went and produced Sunlight. When Sunlight turned up in his first crop at the sales, we'd also, Jake Fadd was being absolutely brilliant and very focused on, you know, we had such belief in him because of the quality of his stock that we went out to buy the best stock by him. And it was obvious to me that the, that you know, the filly was as good as anything else in the sale. We actually bought Zusane as well at that sale. And so we, rather than sell all of it, we retained a leg in her. We bought Zusane. Lean Mean Machine was on our list, but there was some veterinary reason he didn't go through with Chris Waller's team. And we had a good go. Anyway, when, as you can imagine, when the following Coolmore, 2 years later, when we had the first three, including Zusane and Sun, obviously the winner, Sunlight, and Lean Mean Machine was the third that had been right at the top of our list, we started to think we were rather clever at the job. It didn't last like everything in horse racing, because you then suddenly realised that if Sunlight had come second in the Coolmore and Zusane had won it, and there was only a very short distance between them, and with James McDonald beating himself up afterwards, we would probably have been about 20 million better off, because obviously a colt can earn you a great deal more than a filly.
Absolutely. A current stallion at your very own Tween Hills is Group 1 Sussex Stakes winner Lightning Spear. He was a 260,000 guineas buyer from Tats October, purchased by yourself. Could you tell us a bit about what you loved about him at the sale?
So Pivotal's one of the most exceptional stallions. He's an extraordinary horse himself. He was a champion sprinter, big, jowly horse, very powerful, trained by Sir Mark Prescott. But what he's really done extremely well with his fillies, he's a magnificent broodmare sire, goes particularly well with Galileo and that sort of thing. But every now and again you see a colt that really takes your eye, and he just was a magnificent specimen with a great action. 260 is actually quite a lot of money for, you'd pay that sort of money for a middling filly by Pivotal, but it was quite a lot of money for a colt by him. He was remarkable because he won his last Group One as a 7 year old, retired sound. For Pivotals have a bit of a reputation for having a throat issue, and he had a Grade One scope every day of his life. But like all these things, not straightforward. Poor chap isn't terribly fertile. So commercially as a stallion, he's not been a huge success, sadly. But he's the most beautiful tempered horse you've ever seen. So I suspect he's living his best life, even if he isn't getting quite as much sex as he'd like.
Another stallion at Tween Hills is Cameco. You mentioned him earlier. He was purchased for 90,000 at the Kenlyn September sale by yourself. A dual Group 1 winner, as you mentioned, including the 2,000 guineas, defeating Wichita and, of course, Pinatubo, who we're becoming more accustomed to here in Australia. Tell us about him as a racehorse and how his progeny have been received at the sales early days.
Well, as a racehorse, he was everything we could have hoped. I remember the first call I got from Andrew Balding after his first piece of work. He uses the Equiniti system for measuring, you know, all the data, collecting all the data on the horses when they're working. And he said, he rang me and said, you know, I don't want to get excited, but the data readings, this Cameco giving me, the Kitten's Joy horse, is just extraordinary. But I think that we just, let me double check, because I think there must be something wrong with the kit, because he's already breaking records on our charts. Anyway, needless to say, it turned out that he wasn't. The kit wasn't broken. It was absolutely accurate. He did another piece of work. He went to Sandown and won in what's a very hotly competed maiden. He then got beat a couple of times, but I think Machine might even put his hand up and say they weren't his greatest rides. just got there a bit late. Then he went to the Versum Futurity, or the Futurity as it's called, which is the mile group one at the end of the season at Doncaster. Doncaster became waterlogged, and at the last minute, which was a huge blessing for us because he would have hated that ground, they moved in the race to Newcastle on the all-weather. And it became the first ever all-weather Group 1 run in the UK. And he obliterated the field in track record time. We then went into, we went into the COVID winter. And we had this nightmare scenario where we didn't know if the Guineas was going to be able to be run at all because we were on lockdown. And in the end, they pushed the Guineas back a month. So instead of being the first weekend in May, it was the first weekend in June. And he sighed through the field and won it in the fastest ever running of the Guineas. So he's the fastest winner of the 2000 Guineas in history. And yeah, I mean, he then came out and beat the older horses in the Joel Stakes. He, because of the convoluted way that season worked, because it had all been shortened and the races were pushed together, he did get beaten in the Sussex. He wasn't quite, you know, he was just, as a three-year-old, he was on the, he definitely wasn't a mile and a quarter horse. He loved the stiff, straight mile. And Goodwood's running downhill and he got trapped on the fence. He ended up going to the Breeders' Cup and we all got terribly excited there, thinking that he was a good thing for that. But we didn't give him Lasix. Every other horse was on Lasix in the race. Whether that was the difference, whether he just ran a bit flat at the end of the season, I can't be sure. But he finished fourth, I think, fourth or fifth. And it was a slightly disappointing, but came to stud, huge, huge following. And then he started the sort of dream stud season. Sheikh Fahd kept a lovely colt by him called New Century that we homebred, had a potent embrace, again with Andrew. And Sheikh Fahd and Fergus Galvin, his American racing manager, came up with a plan of, rather than going the normal Royal Lodge route, we would go for the Summer Stakes in Woodbine, which is a Grade One, which we did, and he won, and he won impressively, beating a horse called Al Kudra, who's a very good horse of Godolphin's, and he's now on. He's basically trying to follow his father's footsteps and go for the Guineas. Interestingly, the Royal Lodge, which was the race we would have gone for, was then won by a horse called Wimbledon Hawkeye, who's also by Kamiko. So the stallion really, as you can imagine, was capturing a lot of imagination. And at the yearling sales, we sold New Century's Full Brother for $1 million. So that's probably equivalent to $2 million to Godolphin. And he had, yesterday was another, was a great start to the season for him. He had second in the Spring Cup, which is a listed race. Another nice three-year-old winner. And his three-year-olds are already showing that they're, as you'd expect with a horse like him, training on, which is so we're in good shape. He'll have 150 mares this year, and he's flying.
We'll talk now about the partnership between Tween Hills Qatar and Australia's Winning Stud. You mentioned there you have a great relationship with Anthony Thompson, and now standing for Stallions Together over here. How did that partnership initially develop?
Well, there are no flies on Anthony, I think it's fair to say. He's actually become a very, very close friend of mine. I sort of jokingly refer to him as being my Australian brother, though he's quite hard to live with. We've just developed between us all a very good friendship, understanding. And, you know, Anthony's always been very good and given us a call if there's anything happening. And we obviously raced Susane together. Anthony bought into the horse with us, bred by a great Australian friend of mine called Richard Pegum. Funnily enough, it's amazing how these things go full cycle. Pastor Silbano, who's the dam, was bought off me by Richard Pegum. I'd raced her. I bought her as a yearling. He bought her off me, and then went and produced this belting colt that we bought, who was Usain, who's doing so well in Australia as well. So we've always been buying stock in partnership. We've been buying mares together. We've been buying foals together with Red Wall pin hooking. We've been breeding horses there now for a decade or so. And it's been a great ride. And, you know, they've got a fantastic team. We also have, you know, relationships with other people out there. Ryan Arnell at Stonehouse is a guy who started off here at Tween Hills many years ago. And I followed him with interest, actually sold him the dam of West of Swindon. So he's done rather well out of that. And I've got Ryan McAvoy, who was at the Wooden team, is also a very close friend of all of ours. And so we've done bits with Rosemont and Mytho as well. But it's fair to say that that Wooden is sort of, we have a great reciprocal relationship with them. We send some of our best team over there to go and get further work experience. And they send some of theirs to me. And it's a very happy relationship.
You mentioned before that you wished you had have purchased into Zoustar prior to his win in the Coolmore Stud Stakes the day Jimmy Cassidy rode him. Although he doesn't shuttle anymore to Tween Hills, we still see his progeny winning all over the world. How did he actually get on your radar, and how's it been seeing his rise at stud? He's obviously a phenomenal sire and a household name in bloodstock over here.
We were always on the lookout for an Australian colt that could come up to Royal Ascot. There's clearly an angle there. You know, when you look at horse racing as a sort of global scene, you're always trying to find angles, and you're trying to find an angle that will give you an edge that might find you a financial advantage as well as obviously a sporting one. And it's been clear for a while that your middle distance horses are pretty hopeless, and that our sprinters lag behind yours. So it makes sense for us to shuttle middle distance horses down south and try and find sprinters to bring back. So the idea was that he would come back and run it was the Golden Jubilee then, so it then became the Diamond Jubilee at Ascot. And, you know, this was the plan that was hatched. You know, there's a horse with ready-made stallion value that could become an international stallion if he could win at Royal Ascot. And most importantly, would be a runner at Royal Ascot for the family. And we felt that it was one of those really sensible bets that could work out. We didn't realize just how well it would work out, obviously. But initially, it felt like it was working out very badly because literally 4 days before he was due to run at Ascot, he went and knocked himself and couldn't run. Which was pretty devastating at the time. We then discussed whether we stand him at stud both hemispheres from the get-go. The decision was made that wouldn't be sensible because he hadn't run here, they wouldn't really get behind him. The breeding operations worldwide are much more parochial. People love to see a horse run and form a relationship with the horse in their mind by seeing it on the race course. And it would have been almost impossible to have got the horse going reverse shuttling without that. Exceed and Excel, for example, worked because everyone saw him win the July Cup. So we decided to help get him properly established in Australia, which we did with Anthony. And then when he became champion first season sire, it was a bit of a no-brainer to bring him up. Because then we knew he was a good stallion, not just a good racehorse. Has it really worked? Is a question I'll save you from asking. Possibly not to the extent that we thought it would, but that's probably for a number of reasons. I mean, let's face it, he's had a champion two-year-old filly. He's had a Breeders' Cup sprint winner last year. He's been far from disappointing, but he hasn't even been remotely disappointing for a horse at his price point at 20, 25 grand here. But in the context of the fact that he stands for 250 in Australia, yes, he hasn't justified bringing him back because of the, to be fair, the insurance in shipping him back is such a huge expense at this stage that it doesn't really justify the risk. There isn't the reward to justify the risk. So we've left him down there, and we're allowing him to and Anthony to make hay with him in Australia, and breed lots of good horses there rather than bring him back, which is disappointing from my perspective, because as the owner of Tween Hills, he was a massive asset to us, and has bred us some beautiful horses. Interestingly, Yulong have really copped on much faster than anyone else to the fact that there are some very good value zoo stars up here. And Mr. Zhang bought every foal bar the first one through the ring that went through the December sales, including a gorgeous filly off me that Vin and Cox and Mr. Zhang clearly loved as much as I did. I had a Cockney Dancer that, and they paid 92,000 or 95,000 for her. But that's buttons compared to what she would have made in Australia. So it's been an interesting one. Hasn't quite worked out like I thought it would. I thought being an Australian sprinter, he'd be so much better than Europeans. But you've got to remember that the European, the British racetracks are completely different to the Australian ones. Our racetracks are very undulating. You know, you're galloping downhill at Epsom, you're galloping uphill at Sandown, you're galloping up and downhill at Goodwood. The tracks are, if you go to Newmarket, then it's like a roller coaster. And the big, massive frames of the zoo stars, particularly the big, heavy-shouldered colts, sort of struggle with those undulations a bit, which is why he's got a superb record on the all-weather here, because they're nice flat tracks. So that's one of my theories as to why it hasn't worked out quite to the extent that I hoped it would. But it certainly hasn't weakened his brand, if you like, because, you know, as soon as they get a flat track and go over to the Breeders' Cup, they prove they're in the top sprinters in the world.
We'll talk now about one of my personal favourite horses on the track, a horse you raced by the name of Jackano. Of course, the son of Rubik you had in the later part of his career when he won the Group 1 CF4 Stakes. We're about to see his first weanlings hit the sail ring. Have you been out to see them, or if not, what have the sort of reports been like?
I'm actually going to have to ask you, Taylor, tell me, what do you think of them? I don't know. I'm hearing good reports from Anthony and Matt Comerford. Because I only get over to Australia two or three times a year, I get to the farm at Widden in Easter, and I've not seen any of the stock myself yet. So I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully we'll get some good reports in the meantime. Have you seen any?
We did see some foals at the Stallion Parades. That's the only ones I've seen, but they were very nice horses.
Taylor, I'm excited to hear that. Thank you.
Now, you purchased Zoostar's very good son, Zusane. You mentioned that before, in partnership with Guy Mulcaster, another astute judge, for $400,000 in 2017 from the Magic Million sale. He went on to run second in three Group 1s, as you mentioned, that famous Coolmore, which was a Zoostar trifecta behind Sunlight. He's now produced three stakes winnings from his first two crops, including this year's Golden Slipper Chance Balazane. He's no doubt got a great opportunity to keep evolving his career and enhancing his reputation as an up-and-coming sire at Widden in the Hunter Valley.
Yeah, he's a very exciting horse. I mean, it's hard really to quantify how disastrous that Coolmore was for us and for him, because obviously, as a second in the Group 1, I mean, James McDonald told me that summer when he came up and rode in England that he was mortified that it was a shocking ride. He had so much horse underneath him, he just thought he could sit there and put him on the line, and that if he'd gone earlier he'd have won, that he hadn't fully given the filly for being enough credit for being as tough as she was, and it was a shocker. I mean, there's no getting away from it. I think 20 million is a low estimate of what it probably cost us, not least because the quality of the mares that he got was pretty poor in comparison to what he would have got. So it's not just the nomination fee you've got to consider, it's the quality of the mares. And you know, when we went to the first yearling sales with the Zusanes, they ended up averaging more than the first crop of Zoostars did. And yet they were out of mares that it was really quite hard to make a case you know, if you use my sort of principles of what we're looking for as a yearling, it was quite hard to make a case for buying a lot of them on paper. So he's proven that he can get loads of winners, and he's proven with good mares now that he can get good winners. And I think his star is definitely on the ascendant. You know, I can't wait to see his first big winner. It's you feel like it's about to happen any second. And the trajectory is all right. It's all good. So we just got to hope. What we know is that he stamps his stock really well. They're tough. They want to win, and they seem to be getting better and better. So yeah, it's exciting times.
Would you have raced him on had he won the Coolmore?
I think if he'd won the Coolmore, he would have gone straight off to stud as well. I mean, I think the Coolmore is the stallion making race in Australia. It has an unparalleled record. I mean, it's just extraordinary. You go back through the sire line, you know, Zusain, Zustar, Northern Meteor. You know, you keep going back, and it's every single one of them's won the Coolmore. It's a commercial operation we run. I think Australian racing is really interesting because prize money is so good that people do keep horses in training longer. Maybe if he'd won the Coolmore, we would have probably thought about bringing him up to Royal Ascot and cemented him as an international sire, particularly as he was out of a really tough Elnadim stakes winning sprinter that had, you know, we'd actually bought her as a yearling, myself and Joe Lyon, specifically to try and win the Gough Sportsman sales race. We paid 20 grand for her and she did win it. So it was one of those, the only one we bought in the sale. So we got that one right. But that was he had probably an even better profile for Europe because of that than Zustar. So unfortunately, he'd had some respiratory infection issues, and that was that's in the end, I think, why we Chris pulled the plug on the horse, and that he was constantly getting dirty scopes, and so he had great commercial appeal, and he went to stud.
Catawba became a major shareholder in Southport Tycoon after his flashing win in the Group One Manikato Stakes, which made him a dual Group One winner. He's set to stand his first season at stud for a fee of $35,000 plus GST, as broken by NZ Bloodstock News just recently. What does he offer the Victorian market in his first season?
Well, the sire line that we would hope would work very well. This was it's just typical. It's another exciting Anthony Thompson deal. You know, the great thing, he's now got Widden Victoria, which enables him to maximize the stallion's potential wherever it suits best, and obviously Written Tycoon and Victoria are synonymous. So he's a fast horse, and it's going to be exciting to see how he goes. I'd be lying if I said I knew his career inside out. I know that Sheikh Fahd bought into the horse with Anthony in the hope that he would make into an exciting stallion first and foremost. So let's see how it goes.
Yeah, well, he's definitely going to get his chance in Victoria, given both of those Group 1 wins came down here. We'll move on from the stallion side of things, and I've just got one last question here to ask. Obviously, you mentioned you're a massive Hunt fan. I was having a chat to Matty Comerford, and he said for me to look up the Golden Button. Incredible was the first word that I thought of when I watched the first video of this on YouTube. And for our listeners that aren't aware of what this is, could you explain what it is and how exactly you're involved in it?
Well, if you needed any further confirmation of how bonkers Kieran Maher is, he came up and rode in it a few years ago. He actually fell off, unsurprisingly. Surprisingly, he fell off on the flat. But he gave it a spin. It's we dreamt this up about 15 years ago, maybe even more. The original point-to-point, the first ever steeplechase, was run between two churches in Ireland. And we decided that we would run a cross-country race, I mean, almost identical style, but between two pubs along the River Severn in Gloucestershire. And there's about 24 hedges, mostly hedges, a few big telegraph poles, but mostly hedges. There's normally about 70 starters, and anybody can ride in it as long as they're over 16 and relatively sober. And they go hell for leather along the river, and the winners get golden buttons. So everybody gets an opportunity to win a golden button. So the first heavyweight over 15 stone, the first farmer, the first lady, the first junior, the first whatever, and the first non-thoroughbred horse. But it's run very much as a challenge. We're not allowed to call it a race, otherwise we get in trouble with the BHA, but it's a challenge. And there's quite a lot of these hunt races now have jumped on the bandwagon. The Melton was the original one in Leicestershire, but we are we're certainly the one that people want to win. Sadly, this year the river was over, and so we couldn't run it. It was postponed. But you'll normally see a Simmons there. There's normally Lydia or her brother at the meeting. It's a big social. It's a bit like everyone comes as a there's a hunt ball afterwards, and it's a great hooly. It's one of those great things, and it's one of those things that shows you that with a little bit of imagination, you can come up with a particularly where horses are involved in horse racing, a concept that really takes hold and becomes part of the fixture list quite quickly. So we're very proud of the Golden Button. They've shown it on Channel 4 Racing here. We've put a helicopter up in the air and film it. We did before drones came along. Now we can do it with drones. And there's lots of thrills and spills. And if you go onto YouTube or Google Golden Button, you get a few of the highlights, which tend to involve a lot of people falling off.
I do encourage people to go have a look at this, because it is super interesting, and you definitely learn a lot from watching those couple of videos. But David, just to close off here, we do have a little segment called Fast Five, where essentially we'll ask five quick fire questions. They're not all necessarily racing related, but just to try and get to know you a little bit more, and just basically first answers that come to your head, we'll fire away with them. So Taylor, I'll get you to open up.
First question: what is your favourite racetrack in the world?
Cheltenham.
If you could travel tomorrow for a holiday for 1 week, where are you heading?
The west coast of Scotland.
Who was an idol of yours growing up?
Mike Teague, the Gloucester rugby player who was Lions player of the tour, which brings us in nicely to the Lions tour for this year, which I'm coming down for. I'm looking forward to giving the Aussies a kicking.
Bring it on. What is your favourite sale in the world?
Oh, close one. You end up upsetting all the others when you say it. We love coming up to Magic Millions, to be honest. It breaks up our winter fantastically.
And what is one piece of advice you'd give to someone looking at buying their first horse from a yearling sale?
Get some good advice. Don't try and do it on your own, because we've all made a lot of mistakes, and it's better to learn from other people's mistakes than create your own.
That is a perfect bit of advice to finish off there, David. Again, thank you so much for coming on this podcast. We really do appreciate it. No doubt our listeners out there, both in the Northern and Southern Hemisphere, will enjoy listening to this one. Again, thank you so much. And good luck for the remainder of the breeding season there. And of course, the rest of the racing season as well.
Thank you, Taylor. Thank you, Justin. See you on Easter.